It's Friday, April 20th. I'm Michelle Martin. From NPR News, it's Tell Me More. The Virginia Tech community is trying to pick up the pieces after last Monday's massacre, but the pain is being felt thousands of miles away. For some, that pain comes from the fact that the shooter was one of their own.
How sorry I am that a Korean student have killed 33 victims in Virginia Tech. I cannot bear this thought.
The shame of shared identity. Why does it persist? Plus, the church is supposed to be a place that opens its doors to all, but can it offer a spiritual home to a convicted sex offender?
We have to wrestle with the reality that within 300 members of any church, within 50 members of any church, there are both survivors and perpetrators.
One Congregation Struggle on Faith Matters. But first, let's hear the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. The governor of Virginia has declared today a day of mourning for the lives lost at Virginia Tech. Churches and houses of worship around the country are holding prayer services for the victims of the attacks that took 33 lives. NPR's Rachel Martin reports from Blacksburg, Virginia.
Many students have gone home to be with their families. Those left continue to wear orange and maroon as a tribute to the students and faculty who died Monday. And there are several makeshift memorials around campus where students and community members can sign wishes of remembrance. As the university community begins a formal grieving period, investigators continue to evaluate warning signs in the shooter's past. Two stalking complaints against Soon-Wee Cho and a judge's order declaring him a danger to himself and others. Governor Tim Kaine has appointed an independent panel to investigate authorities' response to the tragedy and whether it could have been prevented. The governor has declared a moment of silence at noon local time to honor the victims. Later in the day, Virginia Tech will hold a campus memorial service. Rachel Martin, NPR News, Blacksburg, Virginia.
A manhunt for a California man who allegedly threatened a Virginia Tech-style massacre is over. 28-year-old Jeffrey Thomas Carney turned himself into authorities without incident last night, ending a day-long search that prompted school districts in two Northern California counties to tighten security. Colorado lawmakers say the killings at Virginia Tech make this year's eighth anniversary of the Columbine High School shootings especially difficult. From Rocky Mountain Radio in Colorado, Benta Berkland reports from Denver.
Colorado lawmakers will observe a moment of silence to commemorate the Columbine High School murders 8 years ago. 12 students and one teacher were killed. Colorado Governor Bill Ritter says he hopes the state can take what it learned from the tragedy and help Virginia cope in the aftermath of the Virginia Tech killings.
One of the best things we did as a state coming out of Columbine was to really pay careful attention to the traumatization and the victimization and to assist and to respond.
Columbine High School is closed today, as it has been every year since the shootings. For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is fending off new calls for his resignation over the controversial firings of eight federal prosecutors. During a five-hour hearing by the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday, Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma said Gonzalez bungled the firings.
I believe you ought to suffer the consequences that these others have suffered, and I believe the best way to put this behind us is your resignation.
But the White House says the president has full confidence in Gonzalez. The Bush administration has issued a statement saying the president is pleased with the way Gonzalez handled himself. BlackBerry maker Research in Motion says an insufficiently tested software update was the cause of this week's service outage. The problem left millions without wireless email access on Tuesday and Wednesday. This is NPR News. The U.S. military in Iraq says an American Marine has died and two others have been wounded in a rocket attack on a U.S. military base south of Baghdad. A statement says the attack on the base in Mahmoudia happened last night. Mahmoudia is about 20 miles south of Baghdad. The attack happened as Defense Secretary Robert Gates is making another visit to Iraq, his third in 4 months. Gates' visit comes as debate over a bill that would fund the Iraq War is heating up in Washington. President Bush will travel to Michigan today to speak for a war funding bill with no strings attached, but Congress is poised to send him a bill that includes a troop withdrawal provision despite a veto threat. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said the war can only be won diplomatically and politically. Abortion rights supporters on Capitol Hill have introduced sweeping legislation that would, among other things, overturn the controversial abortion ban just upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
bill is called the Freedom of Choice Act. Its goal is to write into law the protections of Roe v. Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. But it would also wipe from the books many other state and federal abortion restrictions. That includes the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, just ratified by the Supreme Court. New York Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler says the timing of the bill is no accident.
The Supreme Court has declared open season on women's lives and on the right of women to control their bodies, their health, and their destinies.
But for now, the bill is largely for show. Even with Democrats in control of both houses of Congress, there are not enough members who support abortion rights to pass the measure in either the House or the Senate. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
And from Washington, you're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Last King of Scotland, starring Forrest Whitaker, now on DVD.
I'm Michelle Martin. From NPR News, this is Tell Me More. As we close the week that began with the murders at Virginia Tech, many states have declared a day of mourning. Investigators are piecing together how the attack took place, and experts from many disciplines are debating what, if anything, could have prevented it. But when the story first broke 4 days ago, what most of us wanted to know was, who would do such a thing? It soon emerged the shooter was a man, a student from Northern Virginia, an Asian man, an immigrant from Korea. And that caused us to wonder, which of these attributes really matters? What difference does ethnicity or nationality make? It turns out, to some people, it matters a very great deal. We'll talk about why. And it turns out that among the people to whom ethnicity seems to matter are people who share Sung Hui Cho's Korean ancestry. Washington State Senator Paul Shin heard the news before he left for work. Later that day, he took to the Senate floor to express his reaction to the tragedy.
It shocked me more than anything. But after moments of silence, I decided to come for devotional. And in that meeting, I spoke about the situation to my colleagues. How sorry I am that a Korean student have killed 33 victims in Virginia Tech. I cannot bear this thought. How grateful we are to be able to come to this country and do such things. As you perhaps know, in the United States, most of the Korean Americans, about 2 million people, look up to me as a role model and leader. And for me not to prevent this happening is really shocking to me.
Senator Shin is with us now. He joins us on the line from his office in Olympia, Washington. Welcome, Senator, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
What kind of reaction are you getting to your remarks, sir?
From the Korean Americans, I had a talk with the Consul General that what you said in the media, what you spoke about, how you feel, that it helped to mitigate some of the pain we go through, and thanked me. And on the other hand, I got a couple emails, one from the Illinois, one from California, saying that you have no right to apologize on behalf of Korean Americans because it's an individual case, and this could happen to anybody. And I did not apologize. They must have misunderstood as being on behalf of a Korean American community. I apologize. I did not.
If it could have happened to anyone, why do you have any special responsibility to take responsibility for this?
There are about 2 million Koreans dispersed throughout the country, and each family, each student trying their utmost to be successful and do well in this country. And to see these things happen, I took it personally because I hate to see anybody fail.
Do you feel a sense of shame about what this young man did?
I think every teacher feels as similar as I do, because as a teacher, you assume certain responsibility of the welfare of the students and success of the students. When my students fail, that affects me deeply personally, not only as a teacher-student relations, but We have a common heritage. He is a Korean American. Also, I'm a Korean American. And my thought is that what must his parents go through at this situation as we speak now? I'm sure it's a profound effect on them.
We understand that some parents of some of the Asian students at Virginia Tech, particularly Korean students, have been coming to take their children home because they are afraid that their children will become targets of unwanted scrutiny or perhaps even harassment as a result of this. Do you think that that's an appropriate reaction?
We're living in the multicultural society, and whenever something happens to a certain ethnic group, there's sometimes the whole entire group takes a responsibility.
Senator, I can tell you that as an African-American, when I was growing up and some terrible event like this would happen in the news, that many of the parents would call each other to say, oh, I hope this person isn't black. But now I think there is less of that feeling, if I can say that. Why should individuals who are not directly involved feel a sense of collective shame about something that they did not participate in? And some would argue, you know, why should Korean Americans be burdened as a group with a sense of shame?
Every Tuesday morning, we, the legislators, both House and the Senate, we have a devotional service from 7 to 8. And I was prepared to go to that meeting, and I was getting dressed to go. I had to say something because my fellow colleagues are looking at me. Surprisingly, Representative John Mobeck, who happens to be African American, he got up and says, you know, Paul, every time something like this happens, first question I ask is he or is she an African American? These questions kind of reinforce my thinking, perhaps we have a common cultural background.
Which leads me to my question about perhaps whether these feelings or shame are coming from inside out rather than outside in. But I'm wondering whether the argument might be that Korean Americans have no reason to feel collectively ashamed.
I think it's a part of a cultural differences, too. In the United States, we are individual-centered society. We are free until proven guilty, and the individual assumes responsibility. But in Asia, it's a family-centered society, a collectivist society. So what happens is that the community takes responsibility, and the country takes responsibility. So that the common phrase among Asians is instead of my being Korean, our being Korea, and Korea as the whole nation. This kind of a phrase perhaps reinforces the thinking of Korean Americans and Asian Americans. Since the incident happened here, Korean newspapers, we have two daily newspapers, one radio station and one TV station, got together broadcasting throughout the Washington state. We are raising funds to help the families of victims, some are to comfort them and show our respect through monetary contribution. Money is not the answer to all questions, but to show that they care for them and they care for the victims and their families.
You had a conversation with the Consul General from South Korea, and what was that conversation like?
He said, thank you for what you said, and as a fellow Korean Americans, it's a relief to know that you are compassionate towards them, you have understanding towards them.
And why is that important?
Most immigrant community, when they come to the United States, we want a sense of belonging. And we are immigrants, but this is our country too. For example, I came to this country in 1955. I was drafted into the U.S. Army. I serve in Germany. I serve in Lebanon. To serve in the military, they give me a sense of belonging. This is my country. I belong here. But still, you cannot forget the dual culture. America is my country, but at the same time, Korea is my motherland. So we feel compassion for both America and Korea, their value system.
What would you like to see happen going forward?
You know, driving to my office this morning, I was thinking, having this cause may have caused a national attention that the prevention and the safety factor in colleges and the schools. And I'm kind of wondering how many states will follow this suit and trying to pass legislation to school safety and whatever that happens, that I hope this will minimize any the innocent students be victimized as a result of irrational person's actions.
Washington State Senator Paul Shin spoke to us from his office in Olympia, Washington. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So does it matter that the shooter was Korean American? Is it part of the story? And if so, to what extent? We continue the conversation now. Dr. Alvin Alvarez is president of the Asian American Psychological Association. He joins us from our bureau in San Francisco. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
And Phil Yu, who writes the blog AngryAsianMan.com, joins us from NPR West in Culver City. Phil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Phil, if I may start with you, you are also Korean American. Did you feel something personal when you found out the shooter's ethnic identity?
To be completely honest, when I heard that the shooter was Asian, and you know that's all the people were going on for a little while, I selfishly, secretly hope that I hope he's not Korean like myself. Just knowing that, you know, there would be a great deal of implications from that.
What implications do you think there are from that?
On the one hand, I'm completely appalled and just shocked by his actions, and frankly, I'm angry. You know, I'm angry that this individual had to, you know, resort to this. Somehow, you know, I can't identify him, but I felt like I knew this guy. You know, I didn't know him at all, but. As a Korean-American myself and having grown up here and had the same sort of struggles as his family, I think I couldn't help but, you know, we just have this sense of kinship, you know, for better or for worse.
Dr. Alvarez, what do you think of that? Do you feel that other people feel this way? As we discussed earlier this morning, State Senator Paul Shin took to the Senate floor in Washington State to offer, in essence, an apology. What do you make of that?
You know, my thoughts on this is that I think we really need to get to the heart of the question, which is to what extent did being Korean, being Asian American, to what extent did culture actually cause this particular incident? And our professional view on this is that there's nothing inherent about race, culture, or ethnicity that would cause somebody to go on a rampage. This is not representative of someone's race. This is not representative of someone's ethnicity or culture. This is representative of mental illness.
Do you think anybody really thinks that? That there's something about his Koreanness that caused him to go on this rampage? Do you really think anybody believes that?
I'm not exactly sure to what extent people are thinking that, but to say that it doesn't exist, I think it would be inaccurate. I think there are some legitimate fears that when an individual acts, the general society assumes that that's representative of the larger community. We don't even have to look too far. We can just look back at 9/11 and see how the Muslim community, the South Asian community, was held responsible on some level for the actions of few people.
Phil, what do you want to say about this?
You didn't hear people reporting, you know, in the Columbine attacks, two white shooters. Now, two white male shooters, but here you're hearing a Korean American, a South Korean shooter. I think that a lot of ethnic minorities feel this way. When we have successes within our community, it's one step forward. But when, you know, when something like this happens, it's 5 miles back. You know, we have to work twice as hard to sort of prove our allegiance to this country in some ways. You know, 9/11 is a perfect example of that, you know, with Arab and Muslim American communities. And so I feel like in a sense that this is, you know, people remember the bad things and they don't seem to remember the good things all that often.
We're going to pause for a moment. Phil Yu and Dr. Alvin Alvarez are going to stay with us. But coming up, we're going to talk about the media's role in the story. Did the media shape perceptions in the way it described the shooter's identity? That's coming up next on Tell Me More. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More. We're talking about the tragedy at Virginia Tech and the ethnic identity of the shooter. What does it matter that he's Asian? Is it the job of the media to tell us? Still with me, blogger Phil Yu, author of AngryAsianMan.com, and Dr. Alvin Alvarez, the president of the Asian American Psychological Association. And joining us now, Jeannie Mariani Belding. She's the president of the Asian American Journalist Association. Welcome.
Thank you, Michelle. Glad to be here.
Your organization issued an advisory telling journalists to be cautious about referencing the shooter's ethnicity. Why did you feel that was important?
Well, it was important because as we were watching how this incident was playing out across the country and how it was being reported, for a long time, the shooter was identified as an Asian male. And we have seen this happen before in other circumstances where there are broad brush associations made. And continuing the following day into coverage, we still heard the gunman identified as a South Korean shooter.
For those who don't spend their lives, you know, addressing questions of how things are described, can you help people understand why you think it's so important not to use racial identifiers unless they are strictly relevant? Why does it matter so much, in your opinion?
Well, because it does affect the perception of what occurred. For example, if we keep referring to this person as an Asian American gunman, it's a natural instinct for viewers or for listeners to ask, well, was race a factor in what happened? And it's really a matter of good journalism. Is it relevant? Is it germane to what occurred? And that's what we're saying here as an organization that deals with the media.
I mean, I'm going to ask each of you this, and I recognize that for some the question may be offensive. Is it beyond the pale that race may have been a part of it for this young man because it played into his feelings of alienation? Dr. Alvarez, forgive me, you're the professional, I'm not. I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that he was mentally ill. But is it possible that there is any way in which his ethnicity may have been relevant to his feelings of alienation and perhaps his willingness to seek treatment or his willingness to get the ability to get appropriate treatment?
Yeah. I think you've really touched on an important point here, Michelle. Let me speak to this not so much as a causal factor, but as a contributing factor. Without knowing exactly the conditions at Virginia Tech University or his particular experience in there, it's really hard to say. However, you know, based on the experiences that we're finding with Asian American students around the country, some Asian American students definitely feel a sense of isolation, definitely feel a sense of differentness on their respective campuses. That's a function of discrimination. That's a function of racism. Whether that happened in this particular case, I think it's too premature to say that. But it is a reality for some Asian American students.
Phil, what do you want to say about this?
You know, as an Asian American, I have to, you know, bring up the fact that for a lot of us, you know, we have to struggle with the fact that we're perceived as foreigners in our own country. You know, as Asian Americans, we're sort of marked that way. And in reporting about the shooter and identifying as a South Korean shooter, when, you know, it was obvious that, you know, when you look at his immigration history, you know, he came when he was 8 years old. And he lived more than half his life in the United States, and when they kept on referring to him as a student from South Korea, and these are the lead headlines, you know. To me, he's a Korean American guy. You know, he went to school here. He grew up in the United States, and I think there's this sort of subtle, you know, push to sort of foreignize the shooter. I think maybe out of fear that people don't want to acknowledge that this shooter was actually, you know. It was this rage and this anger was sort of was bred in the United States.
Jeannie Mariani Belding, do you agree with Phil?
Well, you know, I agree with him in part, and as an Asian American, I can say that sure, part of it is internal, but part of it is also responsive, preemptive, if you will. If you look at the news coverage, for example, you have Korean American communities from across the country, from Tampa to Los Angeles, and apologizing and saying we're ashamed that this happened for this act. And really, this is not their doing. They have no culpability here yet. Anticipating, I think much of this deals with anticipating any backlash that might occur from this, they are concerned.
Jeannie, going forward, down to our last couple of minutes, so going forward, how would you like this
issue to be discussed? Because clearly the coverage is not going to end, you know, today. So going forward, how would you like media organizations, interested persons, to talk about this in a way that you would consider appropriate while still being mindful of the facts?
I would encourage news organizations to use basic fairness and accuracy principles. Does this relate to the story? Is race relevant as we have these discussions?
And Dr. Alvarez, a final thought from you. What would be constructive in talking about this kind of issue going forward?
Well, I think one of the things that we need to focus on is not so much race or ethnicity or culture, but whether or not and how what contributed to this young man preventing him from seeking help. It's clear he was mentally ill. And one of the things we do know is that within communities of color, there are very clear barriers to seeking mental health, both within the communities themselves as also in terms of actually seeking services from specific agencies. So I think that's where the focus ought to be. What stopped this gentleman from seeking help? Why didn't he stick with the treatment? What ways can we do better as we move forward?
Dr. Alvarez, thank you. Dr. Alvin Alvarez is president of the Asian American Psychological Association. Phil Yu is author of the blog AngryAsianMan.com. And Jeannie Mariani-Belding is president of the Asian American Journalists Association and the editorial and opinion editor for the Honolulu Advertiser. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Each week, we explore issues of spirituality in our segment, Faith Matters. Today, we go to Carlsbad, California, where a congregation is struggling over whether or how to welcome a convicted sex offender. Mark Pliskut was released from jail in mid-2006 after serving time for child molestation. He believes that joining the Pilgrim United Church of Christ can help him, and parole officers generally agree. For sex offenders, they say, becoming part of a spiritual community can be an important step towards rehabilitation. It sounds like a good idea, but can it really work? Can the church be a safe place, emotionally, physically, and spiritually, for sex offenders and everyone else? At Pilgrim United Church of Christ, congregants are grappling with these tough questions. So we're very pleased to be joined by Pilgrim's minister, Reverend Madison Shockley. We're also joined by April Byrd. She's a member of the congregation and part of the covenant committee created to discuss the situation and make recommendations to the community. And Tristan Green is a mother of three boys and an active member of Pilgrim. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Reverend Shockley, if you would start, how did you first become aware of Mark Pliskut?
I received an email from our sister congregation in Santa Cruz, California, about a person moving to our congregation who has a particular history as a registered sex offender who has a history of molesting children. And in the email, it explained their initial shock and their struggling with how to deal with his presence. And they came back and welcomed him under what they called a covenant agreement. The covenant agreement would require that he be escorted at all times while he's on church property, that he would agree not to interact with children. And according to their minister, life went on relatively normally. And so after reading their letter, we proceeded along those lines.
So what was your initial reaction, Reverend Shockley? Did you say, okay, they figured it out, let's just make it happen?
It was, wow. I mean, I've never heard of anything like this before. And I placed a call to someone that I had known had a history of childhood sexual abuse to find out how they would feel about someone attending with that history. And that particular individual thought about it and called me back and said that it was important work to do. And theologically, we really had not contemplated a situation where we would turn someone away. Our bylaws and our mission statement all outline our extravagant welcome to all persons in the name of God. And so we did proceed along those lines.
How did you announce it to the congregation?
Mm-hmm. We wanted to have a meeting after church, but our calendar was booked for a month, and we certainly didn't want to wait that long. So we decided to transform the next Sunday morning worship service into an opportunity to introduce him to the congregation, to have him speak. And so after about a 15-minute liturgy, I said to the congregation, when I was in seminary, we always talked about doing theology, not just studying theology. And I said, well, congregation, this morning we have an opportunity to do some theology. And then he made a statement. He was dismissed while we entered a congregational conversation, and it was quite intense.
And Tristan, is that how you heard about it?
Yes.
And what did you think?
I knew that our church couldn't turn him away, and I was feeling that that would prevent me from attending church with my kids. And I still can't imagine our church turning someone away, but at that particular moment, I said, okay, well, if it's him or us, I guess it'll be us that they can't attend.
Why do you think that?
Well, I thought that even with the covenant team, that I just couldn't put my boys at risk for something like that.
Tristan, have you talked to your kids about it?
I wasn't planning on talking to them until a decision had been made about what was going to happen in the future of the church. And it's been so publicized in the local papers, especially about a month ago, it was all over. And one of my neighbors, you know, brought a paper by right on the front page. There was a big article about it. And my older son looking over my shoulder and grabbed the paper. So we did talk about it. And he just said, yeah, Mom, we should let him come to our church. He should be welcome in our church.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hmm. And that's what I would expect, raising him in our church. That's what we teach, and that's what we believe. You know, I wasn't surprised, but at the same time, he was nervous about it. But we didn't really go further than that because we don't know what's happening.
April, what about you? How did you hear about this? You're a member of the Covenant Committee.
I had received a phone call from Madison, and he said, boy, have I got a ministry opportunity for you. And then he explained the situation, explained that we had a registered sex offender that wanted to attend church at our congregation, and asked me if I would be interested in being a part of a covenant team.
How did you react when Reverend Shockley approached you?
I'm sure there were a few moments of stunned silence. And I remember kind of sitting back in my chair and thinking, oh my goodness, what am I going to do next? And what I found myself doing is saying yes. And I think as I did, I was probably as shocked as anybody else, because as some of our congregants do, I have a history of child sex abuse in my own life.
April.
And what I explained to Madison in that conversation even was, well, here's what you need to know about me, that when I was a young child, I was molested. And so I have a history of having been victimized, and I have survived that, and I've done a lot of work around healing. And my thinking at that point was that this would be an appropriate thing for me to be involved in.
Why?
In part because I am a survivor of child sexual abuse. As I started asking myself the question of why, the first thing that came to me was that there was really a sense of personal empowerment in being able to say yes to this ministry. I do believe in a theology that includes God's extravagant welcome. And this, for me, was an opportunity to be able to live that out and to do that kind of theological work. To not have responded the way I did to Madison and to be involved in this, for me, would have been like saying to the person that molested me, you still have power in my life. And I didn't want that to happen.
And April, it also has to be said, you also are a mother of young children. So on the one hand, you've got your own identity as a survivor. On the other hand, you've got your Christian witness, and you are also a mother.
Yes.
Do you have concerns about your own children, and do those conflict with any of those other two identities?
You know, we know that most abusers are known to their victims. Many of them are family members. Many of them are never reported or never come into the public eye in any way. And so my assumption is that no matter where I go, there are probably going to be persons unknown to me who have a history of abuse on one side or the other. So as far as my children, I feel like my responsibility to my children is to always do the best that I can to keep them safe, but realize that we're always going to be in a society that it has all kinds of people.
And that was the thing that really began to sink in as we struggled with this. It wasn't about this one person that had come forward. We suddenly realized that the image of the church as a safe extended family was a false image. And that's a hard thing to let go of. And the more that I actually listened to April, and I'm reminded that most child abuse, particularly sexual child abuse, occurs within the family. When you take that understanding of where it occurs and extend it to an image of the church's family,
for people who've been victimized, that can be very scary. But it makes it incumbent upon us to address the issue forthrightly. This individual that has brought this issue to our attention could disappear tomorrow or 6 months from now or a year from now. We have to wrestle with the reality that within 300 members of any church, within 50 members of any church, there are both survivors and perpetrators.
What about so Tristan's point, Reverend Shockley, though, that she wants the church to be a place of sanctuary for her children
We all do, and we've all had that image. Now that we understand and have confronted this issue head on, I don't know that there's any church that can honestly say that that environment is available to anyone.
Tristan, how are you now? You told us that your initial reaction was, well, I understand spiritually why the church needs to open its doors, but I, as a mother, have to protect my children. Is that still where you are, or where are you now?
I'm hoping that our church can come up with some sort of creative solution where we have an adult-only situation of worship that we can welcome him to and invite him to become a part of that. If we can't, then I'll have to really think about what I'm going to do with my kids.
Reverend Shockley, do you feel that you might lose members over this?
I don't know whether we'll lose members over this. I think initially that we were certainly looking at a split. I mean, the church was very polarized the first couple of weeks. But as we've come to understand that there are many other churches that have dealt with this, we're learning from their experience.
As a closing thought, if we are to visit with you a year from now, where do you think the congregation will be?
I think we will have a policy. There's no way that we cannot have a policy. We have to look at the future, whether this person's there or not. This person came forward, and that gave us an opportunity to respond in this way. We must understand that there are always persons who have not come forward, not disclosed their status, and we have to protect the children against that as well.
Reverend Madison Shockley, Tristan Green, thank you. April Byrd, thank you. Members all, and the minister of Pilgrim United Church of Christ, thank you all so much for talking about this very complicated and important issue.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Michelle.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a soul music lover tells us how to spot the real thing.
Ultimately, you know soul music when you hear it.
Oliver Wang takes us on a musical trip to Soulville. That's next. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More.
Support for NPR comes from Miller Brewing Company, whose Respect 21 efforts encourage adults to unite and not supply alcohol to teens. Underage drinking, it's not inevitable, it's preventable. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, home to 18,000 new jobs last year, at e-country.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
With the parents of severely mentally ill children, there are no easy answers. What do you do when a child rejects treatment? Should the law require it? I'm Michelle Martin. The tragedy in Blacksburg, Virginia, renews debate over forced treatment for severe mental illness. We'll hear what parents have to say. That's next time on Tell Me More.
I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Recently, we covered the controversy over Ken Burns' new film about World War II. Some Latino leaders feel that the Latino experience is not adequately represented in the film. Coming up, we're going to hear the voices of two Latino veterans. They were recorded as part of an oral history project. But first, this has been a week filled with heavy news. So we thought we'd like to take you into the weekend with a smile on your face. To that end, we have some new music for you. That was Fever. Obviously not a new song, but maybe you haven't heard Sharon Cash singing it before. We found this song on a new album called Soul Sides Volume 2, The Covers. Soul Sides is part of a larger project of Oliver Wang. Wang is an assistant professor of sociology at Cal State Long Beach, and for years he's been running the Soul Sides audio blog. Volume 1 of Underground and Rare Soul was released in 2005. Volume 2 is just out, and Oliver Wang joins us now from NPR West. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How did you get into this? Honestly, come on, really, this is like a mixtape, right?
It really is.
You'd make for your friends.
Sure.
But your friends are like lots and lots of friends, and now it's a beautiful, beautiful album.
Well, I mean, I think the mixtape's a great analogy, and it really reflects the fact that, you know, I started DJing back in 1993 and have been a music journalist since 1994, and I'm also a music scholar in my professional life. And so I've been running Soul Sides, the audio blog, now since about 2003. And I was approached by Kevin Drost at Zealous Records in New York City, who says, listen, you already put this music together for your audio blog. How about putting together a similar concept for an album? Clearly, it worked out well enough that we managed to survive to Volume 2. The theme for Volume 2 is that it's all cover songs.
It seems like with cover songs, there's always this question of whether musicians are being less original than they could be, or are they... taking the lazy route out.
The reason why I love covers, and this has been something that I've blogged about many times, and I've actually had, long before Soul Sides Volume 2 ever came out, I put together my own mixtape of just covers. And what I like about them is that they blend a hint of the familiar. In other words, we recognize the covers because we know the songs, but they're done from a new approach, and hopefully in a creatively new approach. So it gives it a different spin. So you have this blend of something that you know on one level, you know the lyrics to maybe, but it's being presented to you in a whole different fashion. And that's what I really love about cover songs, is their ability to have that kind of balance.
Let's talk about some of the choices for the album. Listen to this. Singing a Beatles song.
Yeah, you can't see it right now, but I'm every time I hear that song, I can't help but lip sync to.
Oh, you kidding me? What do you think I'm doing?
Exactly.
What do you think I'm doing? I hit my cough button so you couldn't hear me sing, because you don't want to hear me sing. Why did you pick this one?
For one thing, I'm a huge Al Green fan, and I discovered this song sort of later on into my discovery of his catalog. And what makes it interesting is it was the very first single that Al Green recorded with High Records, produced by Willie Mitchell, which is the label that he really became Al Green in terms of became a national star. And it was the very first single he recorded for them, but it was a flop. It really didn't go anywhere. I guess people weren't ready to hear a Southern soul version of a Beatles song. And as a result, that song never made it onto any album.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
I think it actually came out in a later compilation that was designed to look at sort of unreleased or rare Al Green songs, and I was instantly taken with it. I mean, it was such a great version of that Beatles song, and the way that Al Green is Al Green on it, I think was just fantastic.
It's definitely a head rocker in the car, you know.
Yeah.
You will draw attention driving down the street. Listen to that. But listen, you follow it by something very different. Let's play a little bit of that.
junkie walking through the twilight. I'm on my way home. I left 3 days ago, but no one seems to know I'm gone. Home is where the hatred is. Such a bad idea if I never went home again.
Some pretty intense lyrics there.
Well, this is Estra Phillips covering Gil Scott-Heron's song, Home is Where the Hatred Is. And what's really remarkable and incredible about both songs is it's a song about addiction, and not just metaphoric addiction, but also literal alcoholism, drug abuse. And both Gil Scott and Estra Phillips, especially Estra Phillips, whose whole sort of life story and career is actually quite tragic because of her problems with addiction, the fact that she would choose this Gil Scott-Heron song of all of them, of his massive catalog to cover, really says a lot about her really expressing something that is incredibly personal, which is about her own demons. And so in listening to the song and knowing about that back history, you realize how much more poignant it is in terms of her speaking, not just a sort of abuse and addiction, you know, as a social problem, but she's really speaking from her own experience as well.
Now, Oliver, would it be rude of me to point out that you're not black?
No, I think that would be an observant point.
So does anybody find it odd or intriguing that you as an Asian American man, and not just, you know, a scholar, you got a PhD, you're a professor and all that, that you're
sure.
So deep into soul music?
If someone finds that unusual or at least worth noting, yeah, I think that's valid perhaps, but for me, it's not something that I'm that self-conscious about. When I'm listening to this music, I'm really listening for the music. And I understand sort of the historical circumstances in which this music is emerging from. And as someone who studies race and thinks about the ways in which race and racism works in society, it actually makes that music all the more poignant to understand the relationship between, let's say, a song like Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come and the Civil Rights Movement and what's going on in America during that time. So it actually enriches my interest in those things.
What's your definition of soul music? What makes soul soul?
Oh, you know, this is going to be a cop-out, except I think it's true. Ultimately, you know soul music when you hear it.
Che Che Cole, why is that a soul song?
I picked that song for a variety of reasons. The original Che Che Cole was done by Willie Colon, the salsa artist. And Willie Colon comes out of this moment in New York's Puerto Rican history where Latin music and soul music have merged and have now become, you know, quite miscegenated. And the song gets covered by Antibalas, which is another New York group, but, you know, an entire generation later, which are these people who are paying homage to Fela Kuti and other Afrobeat artists. It just seemed like a really fantastic collision. And to me, that's part of what soul does well, too, is to really bring together and embrace a very wide array of different kinds of musical and cultural influences. If I can also just add, I mean, the other thing, too, is that that's a very funky song, and you don't get to funk without talking about soul first.
Why do you think this particular music speaks to you so deeply?
Well, I think like a lot of folks in my generation, especially those who came up into music through hip-hop, you know, so much of hip-hop depends on recycling and picking from soul music of the past. I mean, that's the template. That's the bedrock of so much of hip-hop's production. And through being a fan of hip-hop, I was always curious, okay, I know that they're sampling something from the past, be it from James Brown or from Barry White or from whoever. Let me see what it is about that music that today's producers find so intriguing and enthralling. You know, these are the records that they grew up and found in their mother's and father's record collection in their basements and whatnot. What is it about those songs and those artists that they find so compelling that they want to recycle them into the present? And so I really went through hip-hop backwards into soul music and I think discovered those same kind of qualities, the richness, the textures, and really at the very heart of it, just the emotional appeal of soul music in terms of this incredibly emotionally expressive style of singing and the use of rhythm to really bring those kinds of feelings of both sadness and happiness and excitement and sexuality and passion, all of these things out into the surface.
Do you have a favorite track on this album? And I realize that might be like asking which of your kids is your favorite, but do you have one?
I have a couple, I would say. I mean, the Al Green one, certainly. The Donovan Carlos song, which ends the album, it's a cover of William Devon's Be Thankful for What You Got, which especially on the West Coast is sort of this really classic soul and summer anthem, really. And there's something about hearing a reggae version of that song, which is absolutely perfect.
Though you may not try,
I never, never get tired of this song. It's so easy to end with in that way.
Diamonds in the back, the sun moved up, gigging the sea wave against the lee. Diamonds in the back, the sun moved up, gigging the sea wave against the lee.
Oliver Wang is an assistant professor of sociology at Cal State Long Beach and the curator of Soul Sides Volumes 1 and now 2 as well. You can find a link to his blog at our blog, npr.org/tellmemore. Thank you so much, Professor Wang, and thank you for your album. And let's say goodbye to Be Thankful for What You Got. Every week, we reach into the sound vault to find historical treasures. This week's segment comes from a recent conversation about Latinos serving in World War II and the controversy over their apparent absence from Ken Burns' new documentary, The War. Recently, Burns decided to add the experiences of Latinos and Native Americans to his film. We're about to hear two stories from the Oral History Project of Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, who advocated changes to Burns' film. Raimundo Elizondo joined the special services at age 21. He recalls a time when he had to proclaim his Mexican identity to his fellow troops.
I was resented even in the service as a Mexican. But when I first got my basic, I went into this outfit. I went out one day because the bathrooms were outside in another barracks. And as I came back, I heard the fellows in the barracks taught, says, "No, he's Greek, he's Italian, he'll three or four of them, you know." And I didn't realize they were discussing me. But when I came in, this one guy, Buck Shear, we called him, he says, "Buenos dias, amigo." Oh, good. Hey, they were speaking my language, so I broke out. "Hey, wait a minute, it's all I know in Spanish. See you." We tell him, I told him he was Spanish. It's nice that I'm not Spanish, I'm Mexican. Proud of it.
That was Raimundo Elizondo speaking in 2003 about his experiences as a Mexican-American in the Second World War. Our second story comes from Lauro Vega, also Mexican-American. He served with the 197th Anti-Aircraft Battalion in Europe. He recalls an incident at an English pub.
When we first went to England, there was an English, they saw me, it was a little dark, and this English guy asked me, "What are you?" I said, "Well, I'm a Mexican." I didn't know what he meant by that, see? So I said, "Well, I'm Mexican." And there was one guy, a soldier there, and he heard me say I was a Mexican. He got mad at me. He was going to fight me. I said, "Well, what's wrong?" I said, what are you trying to do, deny that you're an American?" I said, "No." I said, "Well, how come you tell him you're a Mexican? You're an American." That's where I learned. I learned right there what an American was. Okay? I was no different than any white guy. Later on, I learned where in my squad, I was one Mexican. We had a German and English and Slovakian and from all over Europe. And I was the only Mexican guy there, see? Mm-hmm. And I learned what we all had the same uniform. We were fighting for the same thing. Mm-hmm. We used to go together and we used to help each other. I learned that, hey, I was just like them. They were no different.
Lauro Vega and Raimundo Elizondo, two interviews recorded for the U.S. Latino and Latina World War II Oral History Project at the University of Texas, Austin. For links to hear more of these stories, visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. We're going to end the program with a segment we call Heard on the Street, where we go out and find people making music, making noise,
being heard out in public. Today, we take you underground to the subway station at Union Square in New York City, where WNYC producer Spencer Wilkings found this gentleman playing classical guitar.
Well, my name is Don Witter Jr. I was born here in New York. I was born in the Bronx. I grew up as a classical pianist and switched to guitar in the 60s when the folk songs came about. So I became a musician after I was 20 years in the computer field as a network analyst. I left in 94 after just being disgruntled. I decided that I was going to quit and just become a full-time musician. I spoke it over with my wife, and this is what I do 7 days a week between performing in a subway system, on the music under New York, and getting other gigs. I plant the seed in their ears and their minds. You know, they may turn around. I see a lot of people turn around and check out my sign and my name, even if they only have a split second. And they actually, you know, they do listen. They do listen. They do hear. Matter of fact, I was walking around in Harlem after a gig, and one guy stopped me and started talking to me and said, "Oh, yeah, you're that guitarist." And then he said that he used to hear me, but would never come and approach me, but would just stand in the back at Times Square. I find that I'm recognized around the city every so often by people who have heard me at different stations. The tips can get very good. I just got a guy who was listening to me just for almost an hour, and he was reading a book, had his lunch, and he gave me a $20 bill. People are really gracious. I've had a situation where a homeless man gave me his cheese that he had for the day. About a week ago, a guy gave me a pillow to sit on. I think I'm doing a good job, and even when I have to get up very early and perform like 7 in the morning, and I'm dragging myself and saying, why am I doing this? The first couple of people usually tell me, I needed you today, or thank you very much for this. It is doing something, even when I don't think so, it's doing something really good for the city of New York.
That was Don Witter Jr. talking about his experiences as a classical guitarist in the subway stations of New York City. And we'll go out today with a little more from Don and his guitar. Thank you for listening to Tell Me More. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. From the Scotts Miracle-Gro Company, sponsor of 30 Days of Green, to help kids value green spaces, Scotts Miracle-Gro, dedicated to a beautiful world. And from Kay and Matthew Buxbaum for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR, National Public Radio.